Okay, this is September 27, 2009. I have Kigi on the line, and Kigi was the recipient of the Hiroshima Prize in 2008, August 6th. He'd been the most prolific poster on five-bodied since 2005 or so, and I decided that he should win the opportunity to take a break. He could read five-bodied, but he couldn't post. So I have not talked to Kigi since then. Personally have not talked to him since 2005 about. I think the last time was when your mother was on the phone in L.A., in the L.A. area? Was
that yeah, I think it might have been Glendale.
Right,
or Whittier.
Right, and that was 2005, I think.
Oh, wait, 2005?
Yeah, I think
we... Well, I didn't get into the L.A. area until 2006.
Okay.
It might have been Culver City.
Right, okay, so it was 2006, 3 years ago, and that's the last time I spoke to Kigi, and then he was on Five Bodied till 2008. I did see Kigi post occasionally in Alt Slack as another name, and encouraged some of his postings. Others I ignored. So, here we are. We got in touch with each other, and Kiki's going to begin by saying what's happened to him since he basically left actively five-bodied. What have you been doing?
Well, around August of 2008, I was still in Whittier, California, and that's when I started to have these changes, you know, like, I was normally known as a poster who is very combative or whatever, very opinionated, but the people who know me personally knew that, you know, there were nuances behind that, and I was just passionate about it. So at that, before that time, I was very obsessive, and, you know, I would post up a lot of statistics about general things, and, you know, that kind of wore on some people. So what happened around that time was I started to discover different parts of our mind and our psychology that are popular beliefs but are not actually true. And so that made me want to change myself in respect to how I saw myself.
Did you discover that in Whittier?
Yeah, that was the beginning, I'd say, the catalyst.
Is it because you didn't put as much energy into posting and started reading different things that you hadn't read before?
I think that was an influence, yeah.
So in that sense, the benefit of the fast, or not being able to have access to five body, was that you had more time to notice things.
Yes, yes, to get more involved and more in-depth, you know, to study it thoroughly as opposed to many different topics.
Right. Now, did you have a Facebook or MySpace at that time?
I had a MySpace.
Did you have anybody following you or whatever you do on MySpace?
Yeah, I can't really remember. I think Chad was on there. I don't know if he wants me to use his first name.
But now you have like 250 or less, you know, people who have access to you. Where's that?
Less than 250?
Yeah, I think Elaine said 250. You said
oh,
no,
that's on my instant messenger. But yeah, I have like that many people in my MySpace. But I deleted a lot of people off of my MySpace. People would occasionally read my blogs. There was a fellow in England who is into the five body thing, and I talk to him once in a while.
But he's into the five body thing. He posts on five body.
Yeah. His name is Robert.
Oh, Robert Window, Robert Bridge, yeah, Rob Window. Yes, he's very active. I met him. Have you ever seen the YouTube he made of me?
I saw one of you in London and a crowd of people around you. And
yeah, Hyde Park. That was Rob. He took that. And you have that strange mute person. You know, he can't speak, but he's making facial responses to another guy ranting. It's
yes.
Pretty funny. Yeah, so that's what Rob did. And that's what some people think it's one of the best Dobbs YouTubes. You know, it's a good one. It's very funny. Okay, so back to you. So when you talk about having these people engage you on the MySpace, are they responding to the new things you're saying that you've learned since last year?
Some of them are. I think Robert is picking up on it. Robert, at that time, he was still new to it. But, yeah, he'd give me some positive feedback. Unfortunately, I didn't get to talk to Chad about my new discoveries. I think he was really busy. I found myself having, like, a strange kind of affinity with convulsionaire, which is funny because I used to be a little, I don't know, how do you say the word, a little bitter or combative or, you know, a little feisty on the news group with him. But I actually started to see little parts of his perspective, and I started to identify with some of the things that he...
Can you
I started to... I don't know if he knew that. I think I made a couple communications to him, like just some
I know Compulsionaire. I saw him last in Toronto in 2007. As a matter of fact, he just sent me something on Facebook the last 2 days. So what did you... What is it, if you can remember, he was saying...
I used to see... like be the anti-environment to the ecology movement slash, you know, green in general.
Yeah.
But that was more, back then it was kind of like a punk rock attitude of, you know, don't fence me in, like decline of the Western civilization, don't tell me to tax this and so on. Or to others it would seem like a libertarian, Republican, you know, screw the earth type of thing. But it really was really from my cynicism from living in the West Coast and these certain ecological groups that were kind of hypocritical or so on about their relation to human beings or believing that the earth is overpopulated or something. So I kind of like had a reaction to that. But when I was
You saw Compulsionaire as an extreme greenie or something?
Well, yeah, I did. I mean, I think I a little overreacted, but then there was a couple of things that made me think so because, I don't know, certain obsessions he had. But the thing was, I started to understand, like, you know, maybe I made that analogy to you, like, the human eye, like, during daylight hours, like, the most variable hue is actually green. And then I started to see there's actually different types of green movements or different concerns in the ecology movement. And I started to look at these different niches. And so I went, quote, back to first nature, because I found myself, I wanted to have, like, a certain type of independence because I felt like I was on the grid, so to speak. And,
so you wanted to be off the grid.
I wanted to be off the grid. So I started looking into agriculture, and I started to notice things about agriculture that I think he would agree with, is that when we went to started going monocropping, these large-scale farms, these corporate farms, basically we took away the autonomy of the small farmer. And people used to think that was just a small concern. Hey, so what? We're supposedly getting more yield when we go to the supermarket, and it gives us more, you know, monocrops like wheat to give to third world countries. But when I started to look at it a little bit more involved, it's actually not quite that simple. And so I started reading about soil ecology, and it's actually when soil is more diverse, we're more able to put different crops on land, and therefore having more of a nutritional yield as opposed to just of the same, you know, product. And actually that can feed more people because there are people in third world countries that are getting these barrels and barrels of one type of crop, but they're still going starvation, and these governments are telling them to take their fields and put it into one crop, and then their foods are eroding away. So I started to see a more personalized version of the green movement that's actually practical and actually empowers the individual.
Right. Now, you know, that's what William Irwin Thompson, that was his attitude. His writing was based on that point. He was against the monocrop agricultural industry.
Yeah, like before World War II, Montana was more than 70% self-sufficient for all its food needs. They even used to grow fruit up there. And that place, you know, gets, you know, like Canadian winds and goes like 50 below in some places in Montana. So people thought this was impossible, but it's really, it's in the soil. And what I also discovered is that when I was Whittier, I found out, like, there's a lot of this cliche, like Umberto Eco is an example of this cliche, that supposedly women are traditionally right-brain-oriented and men are traditionally left-brain-oriented. I actually found this to be somewhat false. The reason why this is interpreted so is because most of our female species, most of the human female, they tend to have a more developed corpus callosum, so they can switch between the hemispheres, so they... And it's definitely true that the emotions are rooted in the right hemisphere and, you know, recognition and self-reflection, and they have that more developed. But the thing is that they were ignoring was the actual empirical evidence. When they had brain scans of males and females, they actually found that males actually had a larger right hemisphere and that women tend to be more symmetrical. And they found evidence of, you know, they're better in the language arts. And actually, they found that high school girls were better in algebra, which is considered a left brain type of mathematics as opposed to geometry.
And this is new research you found?
Yeah, somewhat new. I mean, more to the 2000s as opposed to the 90s, I'd say. more recent neurology and so on, and that changed my perspective, and I started to find out, you know, I was really disappointed in my relationships in life, and I found out, like, I was really acting out of desperation, so I wanted to take a more masculine, quote, domineering aspect, but not like, you know, an abusive sense of the word, but more like, yeah, I want to be in control of things. So I found out that it's actually those that are right hemispheric oriented tend to be more promiscuous slash take more partners, and those that
right hemispheric men or women?
Men.
Okay.
And women, both.
Okay.
And the left hemispheric types tend to be more to one person.
Right.
And
I mean left.
Right, meaning more faithful to one person. And I found it a lot of times in my life where I was near these suicidal situations that I was really, like, desperately involved with one woman, and it tended to have, like, Oedipal overtones or, like, an older woman, and I had to be on their conditions. And I wanted to have a flip side of that, feel more, in you know, on top of things. So in Whittier, I noticed there was an anthropologic research about those that were polygamous societies. They had small-scale agriculture as opposed to large-scale. So that fit into the green thing. So I found a masculine aspect of the green movement as opposed to how it's traditionally showed in the liberal counterculture as, you know, reconnecting with Mother Earth and so on. I found it more as a masculine. I found a masculine variety. So I said to myself, people have lost their autonomy because they were divorced from their farms, and they were made to make basically a crop for the state or for the, you know, the impersonal bureaucratic engine. And I thought to myself, most of these small-scale agriculture that were involved in polygamous societies were actually cultivated by women, meaning it was small-scale fruits, vegetables, things that are easy to take into the soil and out of the soil, as opposed to hard labor on a plow, you know, tilling the earth, which requires, like, more muscular, you know, labor. So I started to see things more tiny, miniaturized, localized, and I started to see all these corporations that went throughout the earth and just took away people's autonomy. And that actually was a part of what happened to some of the food crises in the Soviet Union, is that when they started to go to these large-scale, impersonal farms of one crop, you know, and during one of their food crises, what they actually did was go to a smaller scale. They started to give the individual citizens smaller farm allotments that they could personalize themselves, and that actually helped get them through the food crisis and that happened sometimes in the Soviet Union.
So you thought that convulsionaire would be more...
was on the right path as far as in touch with how the field is grown and these corporations just running away with our land. He was correct.
Yeah. So that's one thing you realized. I remember you talking about being a patriarchal guy, sort of.
I went both ends. I was matriarchal and patriarchal. I just kind of fluctuated up and down throughout the years, just according to some aesthetic or something I was on. You know, I'd say I'm on the patriarchal end now, but it's more nuanced and it's more self-reflective and it's more realizing, you know, it's a symbiotic relationship. You can't be like the chauvinist pig, quote unquote. But, you know...
So that's what you mean by right hemisphere patriarchy.
Right. Like, the traditional right hemispheric male was actually a more dominant male in the household.
Mm.
But even though, in spite of this, he would compensate because he was more of an interdependent mindset. So he would realize the value of the female in his household.
He'd give her space and her roles.
Right. So even though he was the domineering one, he would understand that she had respect and that it was to be respected.
Now, wouldn't that be a result of the printing press and the industrialization of society, which favored the left hemisphere and patriarchy? You could have women running the house, but they'd have to be a left hemisphere patriarch because the society demanded that.
Correct. And this is where the irony comes in, because there are flavors of the left hemisphere and flavors of the right hemisphere. So what happened during the industrial age, we have women coming into the left hemispheric mode, but it's the masculine version of it.
Yeah.
And so then we tell people, oh, this left hemispheric was masculine from the beginning. It wasn't. It was perverted. It was made to go in that direction because in the industrial age.
Yeah.
So that's what we have now, is this irony, and we're flipping back and forth, and people can't attune to it. So it's really more, we have more than just two brains, which is left and right. We almost have like four, like two versions of the left, and two versions of the right. And you could even say you have a fifth brain, which is corpus callosum. So it's really, you know, you could even look in the brain, it has its own enhancement, retrieval, et cetera, fusion. And so I've been going into that, from starting from one to binary to quadrant-like, and just going off of that.
Yeah, that's the way my chart is. I mean, I have two sides on the book, Vatican Communion, two things on the right, two things on the left. Yes, there's doubleness within them, and then there's also doubleness within the quadrants, like Zapp and McLuhan in the sex quadrant. So you're seeing, you started posting these kind of complexes a little bit before you left five-bodied.
Right, right.
And those were interesting. Nobody else even used the chart language. And you would use but you were showing the complexities and thinking that I didn't have a sense of those complexities. Now, I don't want to go into my reaction to that. Let's just continue with what you're saying. Illustrate more. You might want to go into what you see in the street, what you see in polygamy. How did you get involved with Salt Lake City?
That was just kind of like somewhat near. Me and my mother were living in the city, and I thought to myself, well, you know, she makes a lot of money here, but, you know, the rent's pretty expensive here in L.A., so, you know, we're not making any savings. So I figured, where was there a shortage for nurses? Supposedly on paper they said Utah had a shortage of nurses. And
you did that research. Your mother didn't do it. You do the research.
Oh, yeah. I pretty much lead her around on that. And,
right.
You know, supposedly the rent's cheaper. You know, it's not as expensive as, say, living in Seattle or Portland or any other auxiliary cities on the West or, you know. So I thought, yeah, supposedly a lot of people have jobs here. I go find a job. And so I was just curious that, you know, I didn't really have much of a large social network. So I figured, maybe I'd join the Mormon Church. Maybe I'd get some kind of benefits. Maybe I'd get introduced to people or...
So how do you do that? You go to some social introductory place?
I don't know. I mean, like, some people, they like to go to coffee shops or talk to their coworkers or...
No, but how do you even introduce yourself to the Mormon Church to become...
Oh, I just walked in. I just walked in and said I was interested, and I told them, you know, I'm totally ready to get initiated and all that, and they processed me in, like, a week and a half, and then they baptized me and confirmed me, and...
You don't have to take any courses? You don't have to learn some basic thing first?
Oh, they do. They come to your house, and they teach you something about, you know, Joseph Smith, the founder, and what they believe, and their doctrine.
And that's
they
only
test
a few,
you on it a little bit. Yeah.
That's
they
only
even
a few
have an
visits.
Interview.
That's just a few visits. And then,
yeah, like
and then
six,
you're
seven
ready,
visits.
And then they accept you, and you don't have to pay anything.
You have to tithe, but I've never tithed because I didn't have a job.
Right.
And I thought joining the Mormon Church should... get me a job because I thought I'd have social connections because I have the stereotypical, you know, Protestant ethic, whatever, you know, Republicans who live out and, you know, feed a family of a bunch of children because they supposedly have the highest fertility rate. So that I was really curious in groups that had really high fertility rates and maintained them because I thought that was counter to our corporate liberal culture where we don't have children, we just save up. And so I wanted to know what it is, quote unquote, to be like a father figure or someone who, you know, can sustain. But I was shocked by what I came to see there because I was assuming that they had these right hemispheric attributes because of their past in polygamy. But the actual modern Salt Lake-based church is actually has a very left brain hemispheric, as far as the males are concerned, attitude. Like they're very blind, unquestioning. You know, I know a lot of the cliches are true. What they say about them, you know.
So their left hemisphere patriarchs dominate.
They are now, yeah, they are now. They were, at some short period of time in their past, right hemispheric, but that was when they were practicing, like, communitarianism, which would be like small-scale socialism, where, you know, everywhere, even though people would tithe, it would go back to the community. Now when Mormons tithe, all it goes to is the temple. I mean, sure, I've asked them for help, but all they give you is really food, and here's the really what embittered me. They're actually... one of the top three richest churches per capita in the United States. And they have a population almost as much as the Jews. There's like 14 million Mormons in the world. And so I thought, you know, they had plenty of money to spare. And sure, they're quote-unquote generous to certain humanitarian aspects. But I really think that's just their general, as far as people just coming off the street and joining them, they're really not going to give you much more than, say, a training certificate how to... do whatever, or the best thing becoming a Mormon is actually going to BYU, is like getting a very low tuition to go to university. But I came to one of my bishops when I was about to be homeless, and I said, "Hey, my mom and I are about to be homeless, and you know, my mom will pay you back." And they said, "My mom said to him, 'What? Do you think we should be in the street?'" And the bishop said, "Yes." And I thought that was pretty calloused. So basically, I think they're in this corporate, you're out for yourself kind of mindset, even though supposedly, so they're making a mockery of themselves, see, because they had a different past. So I was getting into them because they had this mythic kind of like tetrad quality to them. But
okay, so is this, now your a friend of yours died on October 29th last year. Now, are you in Salt Lake City before that happened?
I was in Whittier about to go to Glendale when that happened.
You were not even thinking of Salt Lake City?
No, not even.
So you get to Salt Lake City in 2009?
Correct.
And how long do you stay there?
I think I was there from May till July 31st.
It's not
very
too
short.
Long.
So yeah, I didn't really have a pleasant experience.
Well, how would they help you get a job? Did you go to the meetings and say, you know, put your hand up, anybody get a job?
Well, actually, here's the thing. The Mormons in L.A. are better because they're more personable, and they're more, you know, their employment service was, they'll find, help you with any job. They'll even get the applications for you, and they'll send it out. But when I got to Salt Lake, they sent me to, like, some employment service, and when I went there, the whole room was full of people with bachelor's and master's degree, and I was like, hey, I don't have a college degree. I'm just trying to find any work here. This was kind of like a slap in the face, and I kind of told my bishop, hey, I don't have any of these qualifications. What am I doing here? And that's the only really help they gave me, except maybe someone in the church who said, well, my so-and-so friend works over at this restaurant, maybe you can apply here, you know, like / nepotism networking or whatever. But yeah, it's just like the more you see it on small scale, like towards the hub of the church, it's very corporate oriented. It's actually, I think, the Mormons who live in the larger cities who are actually more informal. You know, because I actually went to like a Mormon dance, and they're basically playing techno music. Like this one.
Where was this though? Is this in L.A.?
This is in Glendale, north of L.A. And he just rented out the church like as a discotheque, and they were playing like basically techno, and you have kids there hanging out, basically gyrating and stuff. So it's like a totally postmodern situation. You know, it's totally postmodern in the larger cities, but when you go to the smaller areas, they're very. Pretty much, they stand up to the stereotype as they're portrayed by the media. They really are pretty
okay.
To themselves.
Right.
So that was just some exploration I had, and that was just so I can have some auxiliary social network, thinking maybe I'd find help in life. I'm not a dogmatic person. My beliefs are actually quite heretical to anyone. So
you're dogmatic in phase. You're quadriphenic. You go, you're dogmatic about this, and then
That's when I go process. That's when I'm busy working something out, and then I get dogmatic, and then I have it completed, and then I pass over it, and then I shift. So yeah, I have these phases of where I'm this very OCD like, you know, statistical observations, and then I go over into something else.
Right. Now, you always knew.
But it's dialectical, because I often attack what I've just went through.
Right. And
it's
You always knew that that's what I meant by quadriphenia.
It's more dialectical, comparison, synthesize, move on.
Yeah. And I give an alibi for that. So if you know
I've known you since, like, I was 19, I guess.
Right. Now, I'm saying...
Or 17 if I read you on paper. I saw you in person at 19. I read you on paper at 17.
Yeah, so you're born in 1983.
Correct.
And the winter 2000 paranoia comes out with the Matrix article by Guffey, and you read
correct.
That. And that
correct.
Would be in 2000. So you're 16 going on... You're going to be 17 in March 2000.
2001, I would have been 18.
No, I said 17. In March 2000...
Oh, yeah, I would have been...
become 17, and that means
correct.
You would have heard me in
yeah.
technically your 16th year, but you're actually in your 17th year, and then it's completed on March.
Yeah, because I don't know when I read it, March, April, or something, I don't know.
Right, and you immediately emailed Guffey, and then you started emailing me, and you were the Vampire Church? What did you call yourself back then?
Oh, yeah, there was a... Not the official Vampire Church, which is legally recognized in Lacey, Washington, which is a suburb of Olympia, Washington, which is actually the world's first legally tax-exempt realized vampire religion, but it was another auxiliary one. And it was just the occult,
It was your own name for yourself, right?
Well, yeah, it was my email, but the email came from, like, a vampire, quote, church. Like, they gave emails to people who were...
You were a member of that spinoff.
I would peruse, I'd read their stuff, yeah.
When you were 16, 17?
Yeah, I was somewhat of a goth then. Like, I was into gothic culture, sliding into...
What do you think got you into that?
The goth culture?
The goth culture. What, when you're 15, 16, is, if you know yourself better now, what is that attracted you? Do you know? When you're 15?
Well, let's see. When I started getting into music, I was like probably 13 years old, and I just listened to general things on MTV, just very mainstream rock, I'd probably say.
And you were in Florida then?
Yeah, I'd say Florida. And I'd be into a little punk rock, a little metal, and then say around 14, I get into Marilyn Manson a little bit. I kind of liked his shock antics, and I was kind of feeling disgruntled about Christianity or whatever, because even though I was raised in like a pretty much non-religious home, because my mother converted to Buddhism at the age of 18, and, you know, she was into different philosophies and so on, I was living with my grandma at the time, and she was pretty much a strict Catholic, so... Like, once every weekend or whatever, she would take me to church, and I just felt like society was pretty hypocritical there in South Florida, and just some rebellious attitude, and so other kids got me into it. I got into skateboarding, so a little punky goth.
But that's normal, right? Most kids
Yeah, kids, they go into their little scenes that they have for them, whatever.
And so then you're a vampire, or you're into that. Now, what's interesting, without getting distracted on it, is Ion's doing a lot on vampires. Very interesting you bring it up. That's for the future.
Well, I got into vampires several times. I mean, there was one time I was in Berkeley, and I went to, like, a Barnes & Noble's, and there was this book. It was, like, a very common philosophy book, mass marketed. I think it was, like, Chicken Soup for the Soulless or the Undead.
Yeah.
And there was this little piece by this person that was talking about vampirism and Heidegger, and how Heidegger, if you ever read some of his books, he would make references to the vampire in a very scornful way, as, you know, something that's neglecting death, because Heidegger believed that we must approach death to find this pure ontological state of being or whatever. And so he's saying the reason why I was so afraid of vampires is because the vampire is like a collective, because all the vampire's victims would become a part of, like, a larger identity, and no one ever died. And it kind of was aristocratic and socialist at the same time, which entirely pissed off
Heidegger.
Heidegger, yeah, because he wanted it one way or the other. He either wanted it folk, or he either wanted it nationalist, or he wanted it, like, this transcendental, idealistic state. But the vampire is aristocratic in the sense that, you know, he was the count, remote from the city, above common life. You know, he would give himself greater things, so that's the aristocratic element. But the irony would be it was almost socialist in the sense that, you know, all those in his coven were part of, like, this group mind that kind of shared. So
he objected to that. Heidegger did not like that.
Yeah, he did not like the group mind. And Helsing, you know, is like this famous vampire hunter, and you describe vampires as filth and so on. And so I identified with that when I got in Berkeley, because I saw myself surrounded by Heideggerians. And at that time, I would call the ecologists Heideggerian, because they thought that, you know, at least the dogmatic ones I was coming across believed that, you know, there has to be some kind of death involved. And that's how I saw their idea of population control, that we must put the brakes on civilization.
Right. Now, you're in Berkeley 2005 or 6. This is when you're doing porn?
No, I think that was 2006 or 7.
So why
didn't
you in Berkeley?
I didn't get to California in 2006. Oh, my mother moved up there on a travel assignment. And, yeah, I was doing that, but that was in San Francisco. But, yeah, I was just train ride over.
How much porn did you do?
Three videos, I think.
And what's it like? How did you find out? Is it easy to find on the Craigslist or something?
I was looking on the Internet, and I knew that there was two major areas in the country that have the most of it. It was basically the Los Angeles area and the Bay Area. And then I read something that the Bay Area surpassed the L.A. area as having more of those studios, so it'd be easier to find. So I looked on the website, and I emailed someone, and I just sent them my HIV test results that I was negative. And
that they do. That's all you. You get in touch with them, and they don't. It's not real secret. They just say, "Yeah, you want to try? Okay, give us some paperwork." and extend that, and then they say come someplace, and what happens? Do you audition, or they just simply put you in right away?
They just look at you, they talk to you, and they want to know if you can perform in front of a camera, and which I did, and it was acceptable, and I felt like I got acceptable. I'm not ugly or anything, I'm just, you know, standard looking.
You had to perform by yourself in front of the camera?
Yeah, for the first one, yeah.
They wanted to see how self-conscious you were. And if you could do anything in front of the camera, that was okay.
Right.
So then, are there other people sitting around? Are you in a lineup?
Yeah, pretty much like the director/interviewer and then the cameraman.
Wow. And then they say, okay, we're going to do something. You're going to get paid for it.
Right.
And what's the pay?
It's not very much, but for someone who's like a slacker like me, you want cash on your hand, it's like according to scene. Like, there's different pay rates according to who you're working with and what you're doing, but I was like, the company I was with kind of did like short and quick, dirty and kind of thing, but I got $300 for like a anal scene, and I was the bottom, so that was like $300 right there.
And the goes up on the internet immediately, the stuff?
Yeah, they publish it in a couple of weeks. They just put it in their computer, and they edit it, and it's like mass produced, and it's sent like in the local shops and everything, and people buy it.
Did you make any friends in that scene?
One. I guess I should have kept him as a friend. I lost it, but I was a little paranoid of doing it further because the one I was at wasn't using condoms. So I figured, you know, there's pretty high AIDS rate in the Bay Area. So I was like, my friend said, you know, he only does scenes with so-and-so, if I thought I was going to continue it, I was going to do it with someone I trusted.
Right.
So,
because
like, yeah.
You were bragging about this on Five Bodied.
Yeah, I'm a very dilettante, you know, it's funny, considering, you know, different personas I went through, but yeah, I started out as like a street/persona when I was 20 in Seattle, like,
yes,
semi-
Seattle was the first time, when you had, and then when you came back from Seattle, you went into the Rouge cult. But before, it was in Seattle where you went into the underground, really went into the underground.
Right, yeah.
And that's
like, I was basically a squatter living, I mean, real squats, not fake squats, where it's actually abandoned, and it's, which are very rare these days, and I was with the punk kids, and, you know, I'd scrounge up money however I could, and
But your mother was out there.
That's when I kind of separated with her, because usually I'd be with her, but she was kind of like another part of town. And I just felt kind of like I wanted some space, so I just removed myself from her, and she was just always trying to look for me on the streets, like asking people, have you seen so-and-so?
We were talking before we started taping, I forgot to tell you, did you know that Dave Wurster knew Anton LaVey in 1961 in San Francisco before he became the head of the Satanist Church?
I did not know that. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's in the interview with Wurster. I wanted to tell it to you an hour ago when we were talking. So anyways, so you're in Seattle. What did you think of Seattle? Because I have a lot of good memories there, but that's 40 years ago.
When I was 15 and I was 20, I liked it because it was like a new experience. Like, because I was raised in, like, after I was 11 years old, see, when I was 11, I lived in D.C. and Maryland suburbs surrounding D.C., like in Bethesda. But after that, I went to these southern areas in remote parts of Florida and North Carolina, and I just felt very dismal about the pace of life there and a lot of boredom. And so when I was in Seattle, there was a lot of activity, a lot of people around on the streets.
When you were 15 first, you're saying?
Yeah, I was out there in a 15. That's when I started to transition between, like, the goth identity and, like, a synthetic reality. I started to become more into, like, electronic music and start to get ideas about, you know, transhumanism or whatever.
Were you taking any kind of drugs while in Seattle at 15 when you started?
No, I didn't really become a drug user until I was 20. I mean, I think I did marijuana when I was 19 or 18, but I didn't do hard drugs until I was 20.
Right, and that happened, so you go back to Seattle in 20, and that's where you do hard drugs and prostitution and everything, right?
Yeah.
And what did you think of yourself in that situation?
Ambivalent, I guess. A small part of me was kind of excited, just living like a quote-unquote slacker, even if it's somewhat degrading, and some part was didn't care. I guess I had a bisexual identity then. I guess that's how I identify myself, so I didn't really care. There was some up and down, some disappointments, but I had a lot of fun, I would say, in a lot of social contexts. But then as I get older, that starts to change, like a flip. Like when I turn 23, 24, I become kind of like it becomes like an old mask of myself.
Right. Now, you're only in Seattle for 6 months to a year, right?
I arrived in Seattle when I was 20, just after my birthday, so just April. And I leave, like, January, February the next year.
Right. And that's when you come back and you stay with your relatives in New Jersey.
Correct.
You get in touch with me, and you say, I want to go into the left hemisphere now.
Yeah, because I had no idea what that meant. I was paying attention to the mainstream idea of that, because I wanted to be rational and orderly. And
see, something about the Seattle thing bored you. You did not want to be what you thought was being irrational.
Well, because I felt like I was, you know, like when you're young and you're hip, you kind of can flow through it pretty well, but then your charms and your so on just dissipate, and then you just see people that are pretty opportunistic around you, and they're pretty nihilistic, and then you get pretty disheartened about that. I was trying to see a girl there who lived in the streets or whatever, but she never really got into me because she didn't really, I guess, respect my identity or whatever, even though she was herself bisexual or whatever. But so, yeah, I went to this cliched idea, well, I need to be orderly, I need to be rational, I'm tired of these existentialist people who just waste their life away.
Yeah, now, you liked them at first, and you're saying either familiarity breeds contempt, or something becomes boring about the group, about the subculture you're with, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
And
so,
this goes on and on and on in my life.
Right. So then you come to the East Coast, and I said, well, just call up the LaRouches. At least they'll give you room and board, and you just go around just hand out pamphlets, and everything's okay, right?
Yeah, at first.
Easy, yeah. Right, I didn't mean, no, I said okay in terms of, well, at least I can get some, I can eat.
Yeah, it was better than being homeless, I guess, or living with my father, who was a pain.
So were you able to, you see, you had this, we'll call it your wild side, and you're in the LaRouche group, and the wild side then pops up, right?
It's still I still act rebellious even when I'm there.
Yeah, and you started to piss off Jeff Steinberg and other people there, right?
Oh yeah, and all the youth, and there were cliques versus cliques, you know, mostly kids between the age of 18 and 25, and they're dividing them, and you like have these upper middle class kids from New England, and then you have the kids from the urban area like New Jersey and Philadelphia, and you know they're always talking about like how many calls did you make today? Did you make like 40 calls? And I was the laziest one there. But even though I was the laziest one there, I'd at least put some standard input every day. I'd still show up every day and hand out the pamphlets. And a lot of people resented how lazy I was, but I wasn't the most, you know, some people wouldn't even show up, you know, and just leave for like 4 days or whatever. It's like all different personalities there. And so there was like a pecking order, and it kind of irritated me. But I tried to start my own little thing, but it wasn't very well.
In the LaRouche group, you start your own version of LaRouche?
There was like so-called outcasts. But even though we were the outcasts, I mean, we did have people in our group that were capable. I mean, we had one guy from Nigeria who's very well versed in, you know, advanced geometry and, you know, who was once an engineering student. And, like, these snotty kids from New England would treat him like shit. I mean, he was just as intelligent as they were. He would start classes and he'd give, you know, those mathematical demonstrations just as much as they would, and that's why they couldn't peck him out, because he did have competency. I mean, so they were trying to fuck with us, and then we had this one Swedish guy who was like, you know, very, 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 you know, typical, you know, that stereotype of the Nordic way. He's very uptight and so on, and, you know, he wants to make sure everyone's making up early and doing all their work. But at least he was fair, you know. He wouldn't gossip or lie about people, so he was kind of like a part of the group in a certain way. He was just kind of the impartial observer, just making... He really believed in it, you know. He really just thought, like, he's working to save the world and everything. Like, and I don't really think... He's not getting a profit out of it, because he rented out his place. And, you know, these expenses are coming upon him. It's not like he's making a profit, you know, because they only give... like the young ones only so much money a week, you know, just enough to eat.
Yeah.
You know?
So you were there, quote, cynically. You didn't believe that you were changed the world. And,
right.
And in the, what sounds to me like you're among young people in Seattle, they're an underground culture, now you're with sort of a respectable cult, at least they're trying to be left hemisphere, but they're both young people trying to work out their hierarchy of themselves and their identity. It's always
Thing. 18 to 25, yeah, that's the age group there.
Yeah, like it's happening in the frats, it's happening wherever the kids are in your group, born in 83, wherever you went, you encountered the same natural human nature going on. Some kind of human nature of kids trying to establish their self-respect, their worth, and where can they impress people.
Correct.
Yeah. So you recognize that. That was the benefit of the LaRouche world. You go there to supposedly ideal place, rational people, and they're the same idiots as where you were in Seattle.
Yeah, like stuck up or, you know, double-tongued, you know, like, or even classist. Supposedly they're talking about, yeah, we're going to abolish the university and everything and just decentralize education because, you know, the imperialistic or the university. Meanwhile, you have this pedantic person who has a family and comes from a double income family and, you know, connections, and they don't really need to be there for anything, and they're complaining about you, why'd you showed up 1 hour to the, you know, somewhere, for $40 that I'm not even taking from them. I'm taking a $40 a week from LaRouche's whatever, you know, little account that he gets from asking people. So it's like, you know, if I'm going to get bitched out by someone, I'd rather be some old person than the young people. It's like, damn, isn't there any camaraderie between the youth here? So that's why I disapproved of it, because if someone, the older ones, complained, I'd say, okay, you got a given because I'm being a slacker here. But it's just, I couldn't tolerate it from the young ones because I thought that was just, like, what was wrong with them, you know? We're supposed to be on the same team here, so.
And aren't they, in both scenes, Seattle and New Jersey, they're both kids who are avoiding a crummy 9-to-5 work office routine. That's really what the point
is. Most of them, yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, that, you can have fun in LaRouche Group. Run around, pretend you're doing something, and you don't have to show up in an office. You just have to show up for that situation, but you're sort of interested in what you're talking about. It's always an avoidance of the pain of going to work.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay, so then you do LaRouche till 2004, because I know I saw you in 2004. You went up to Boston, and you're part of the Democratic Convention up there.
Yep.
And changed the world up there. Help create Bush as the next, for the next second term. You help do that by being just what you are in the LaRouche movement.
I mean, yeah, because they are Democrats, even if they are right-wing to the perspective of whoever. They were on the Democratic ticket, so whatever.
Who? Bush is? Who is?
No, LaRouche was on the Democratic ticket.
Yes, even though he's right-wing and Republican to most people.
Right.
Yeah. But the thing is that LaRouche was the only one, apparently your group was the only one looking active in the traditional form of an excited convention.
Well, at least on the lines where they're entering the convention, I would say, would probably be the most visible one there. And the only other people who were visible there were truly disgustingly right-wing bigoted people. I mean, that's when I started to become very disillusioned. I walked up to this one area around the convention, and there was like this seriously racist person screaming. I don't know, it was like some kind of Nazi KKK thing, but it was pretty extreme. It was pretty extreme. I was like, holy shit, right in the middle of Boston. And then I later discovered there's a lot of like racist undertones to Boston.
Right,
know?
But like, who are these people? Are they part of the Democratic Party or just protesting?
They're just protesters, but it's like, it's funny how people complain about the LaRouches. Meanwhile, they got all these other right-wing people in front of the convention doing much worse, you know? So
right.
I'm like, whatever, it's all according to the media market, I don't know.
Right, so do you think that because the LaRouche youth had high profile, that the general voters who might have noticed that would think that the Democratic Party was really lost because of that kind of people were around it? Do you think you hurt the Democratic Party by being...
No, actually, I think in spite of a lot of miscalculations that LaRouche has, in spite of his very radio personality, non-visual, tactile like, way of presenting himself. Yeah, very brusque, very abrasive.
That is tactile. Tactile is brusque. No, you're right there. Tactile kinetic.
But in spite of that, he did have reasonable requests, and it wasn't like saying, okay, we're going to have turn the country into one national party. You know, they kind of exaggerate. He's just saying basic infrastructural needs and how money is being spent. And, you know, he just talks a lot of economics about a lot. I mean, he goes on tangents about culture, which really pushes people away. But I actually think, you know, there was a couple of LaRouche kids that actually handed pamphlets to people who were in the circle of Terry McAuliffe, who actually was later found to be a little bit damaging to the Democratic Party, because there was kind of like a little Republican liaison between McAuliffe And so, really, the Democratic Party was destroyed from within before even LaRouche's came there. So I think there was some positive effect of LaRouche being there, because it made them self-aware of, like, hey, what's really going on with our convention here, and why can't we get more representatives, and, you know, why are we voting like the Republican Party? Why did Clinton vote for the war, and, you know?
Right. So
I mean, she did. I mean, she received more defense lobbying, I mean, you know, just right before candidates elected, than any other candidate, and people would assume it would be a Republican. I can't remember who had the second most. Maybe it was McCain got the second.
Yeah.
I don't know. But Hillary got the most, and people would say, Hillary? She was definitely a part of that military-industrial swage at that time, and so, you know, people just don't pay attention to that. They're too special interest. And that's what my favorite quote that the LaRouches use is, when a person is just going into their own little zone. It's like, you're too special interest. Like, yeah, we can't vote for an abortionist. We can't vote for someone who doesn't have perfect green. You're too special. Either way, left or right, you're too special interest.
Right. So I had another thought about that. So what did you think of Jeff Steinberg and those? Did you talk any of my ideas to some of your buddies that in your clique there?
I did.
And what did they think of that? Probably
some thought, hey, you need to stop dabbling with that guy. He works with, like, British intelligence agents, or he's against us.
Or special interest.
Or he's an existentialist. He's insane. But a couple other guys are like, that's interesting, which was the guy who, I can't quite remember his name, but he was pretty intelligent, and he was a part of my group, too, so I talked to you about him, and he thought it was kind of interesting. So it wasn't completely, you know, like, I think you saw him on the street there at the table, so.
Do you think some of those kids are still in the group?
So I bet a couple of them. I bet a lot of the newcomers are probably gone. Like, a lot of people who weren't already into it or get tired of it, because there was a lot of pecking ordering shit, you know. Like, there was this guy from New Jersey, you know, ex-military or whatever, and he's just like an average Joe, right? And so, you know, he felt like he was a victim of racism there, and I think he was right. But see, the racism, what the outside media doesn't understand, the racism doesn't come from LaRouche. It doesn't come from the LaRouche organization per se. It comes from these neurotic people who find themselves in that situation in the first place. So I kind of identify with him, you know, and then they sent him off from, you know, New Jersey, New York office to, like, Philadelphia and then D.C. The more south they put you, the more when they punish you, because you get, like, you know, it's more strenuous, you know, and the more north they put you is the more they spoil you. So then they sent him all the way to L.A., which is actually kind of strenuous because the living conditions over there with a house of kids. I was like, I felt really sorry for him, and, you know, I was on his side, and I would be very combative with these group of kids from New England, and I just found I couldn't take it anymore, because I saw how they treat not just me like shit, but other people like shit, and I was like, you know what, fuck this little New England clique, and, you know, I just eventually left.
Right. Now, is there anything you'd like to put on the record of what you thought of Jeffrey Steinberg? He's still the most prominent guy, probably.
Oh, he's fine. You know, I mean, I sense that he's a little, like, irritated by my presence there, or kind of, like...
He knew you were connected to me.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was, but he didn't go, like, overboard on it. He's like, he has to leave now. People... kind of like the higher-ups, they kind of saw my ambiguity and they dealt with it. Hmm. Like, they gave me some talking sometimes when I act really irresponsible or stay at the office too late or not show up or start talking some shit. And, you know, I get yelled at one by one guy, but they kind of accepted me and my ambiguity. I really got most of the shit from the young kids I was, like, dealing with every day. So,
oh, that's interesting.
I mean, Jeffrey Steinberg and the others kind of, like, they totally didn't understand what I was trying to talk to him about. Your aspect, but
yeah.
I mean, they kind of left me alone. I mean, I saw a look on fear on LaRouche, though. I was at this little camp get together, like out in Pennsylvania, like central Pennsylvania. They go drive out here, and like basically the whole East Coast goes there, all from like DC to Boston. All those little offices, they drive out to Pennsylvania. So it was like a little camp out there, and it was basically the same thing we do every day anywhere. We just read like this classical stuff, like. Okay, like the musical notes of Beethoven and Mozart and old German poetry from Schiller and et cetera, and, you know, just the basic LaRouche stuff. But
yeah.
While we were there, it was kind of like a social get-together. I guess it was kind of like how people, you know, release their steam. So I saw LaRouche there, and he's walking in into one of these little areas where he was going to make a speech, and one of his assistants says, "There he is," or, you know, like, "That's the guy," like, "Bob." And he points to me.
Wait, one of the assistants of LaRouche points to you and goes, "There he is."
Yeah, the one with Bob.
You heard him say Bob?
Yeah, that Bob, like the Bob, like
well,
you.
Well, here's the
I know
thing.
He meant you.
Yeah, here's the thing.
And LaRouche,
August,
you know what he gave me?
Tell you the timing, just before you get into that. It's in August 2004, bro, that I do this long interview with LaRouche, and I was told by the PR person set up that many people, when they heard it, said, "Who is this guy? He knows more about LaRouche and his stuff than any of us." And it's like he's been studying LaRouche for 30 years. So I would have, and LaRouche would have said after, "Who was that guy?" You know, to the degree he couldn't remember me because I knew him before. And that's why it would come out. It must have been around August, right? This is a summer camp kind of environment.
Yeah, 2004.
It probably was
right
the very day. It was probably the very day, Great Synchronicity, that I interviewed him. Right? And then they walk out and they're talking about, "Who is that guy who had all that great stuff?" And then they see you, that there he is, that's the guy. That's one of his people. You know
I
what
think
I mean?
That's why they gave me, like, they treated me ambiguously, because even though I was very irresponsible and didn't, and was very outspoken, I guess they just say, "Well, we can't."
Well, actually, you're being like what they are. They're outspoken. You had the energy, you know, and they can't deny that.
And so his first look was kind of like somewhere between shock and awe. I mean, like, he's like, I actually saw his lips open up and his eyes just open up. You're like, and there was numerous times I tried to get LaRouche's attention, like at various other speeches he had, like in Washington, D.C. or Boston, and I come up to him and ask these random-ass fucking questions. And everybody's like, "Why the hell did you just ask LaRouche that?" And LaRouche would try to answer. It's like, "So what did you think about McLuhan?" And he's like, "Oh, you know..."
That was after that first encounter.
I can't remember the first time I met him. It's just so many years back. But I saw him several times, and I've asked him these questions. And he'd be like a little tense, like trying to brace himself for something. And then after I ask it, he just goes, like, almost, like...
Yeah.
I was like, "I'm serious. I'm not here to screw your shit up. I'm just an intellectual shit."
Yeah, I have some relevant questions.
Yeah, you know?
Outside, like, of what they normally talk about.
Right, you know, like, I wish I had British money, but I don't. Not yet until I get married, but actually that's her parents' money. I'm not going to get any of it myself if she doesn't have it.
Right. So after that, you go to university for 10 minutes, right?
Yeah.
Down in Pittsburgh?
Yeah, no, not a university. It's a community college. It's south of Pittsburgh, West Mifflin. I was going to go in for robotics. But my financial aid didn't quite cover that, and I didn't withdraw in time, so that went into debt. And I was kind of, like, dissatisfied with my teacher. You have to have electives. So I picked economics, which wasn't really a smart thing to do because it's very mathematical. And I was really displeased with my economics teacher, and I just felt like the social life wasn't there as much as it could be. And, you know, it was just either people who stick to themselves, very miserly or redneckish. I don't know.
And
so, yeah, I was
doing
robotics.
Yeah, and while you're doing this, you're posting on Five Bodies, or Five Bodies might have just started around then, or at least you're sending emails to me, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you called me from the university the day you quit. You know, you were pretty depressed. So what doing any bisexual stuff or sexual activity while in the LaRouche or in the university?
Let me see. In Pittsburgh, almost, not quite. I don't really think I was. There was not, everybody in that town is poor, so it was kind of connected to my prostitute identity. So I don't really think anything really happened. It was pretty. And people are a lot more masculine in that city. You know, there's a lot of homophobia. So, you know, I just kind of kept that to myself. I was like,
right.
So I didn't. But in when I was in LaRouche, yeah, and it was just random. I was in Philadelphia at the time, and it's really fucking hilarious too, because I converted to Islam in 2004
while with LaRouche.
Right.
Now, why did you do that?
Because I was totally getting into this whole monistic aesthetics, and since I was starting to think about what if there is a God, so I started to get back into theology, and I thought to myself, well, my displeasure with Christianity is always painted God as a human being, and I thought maybe God was more abstract than that, and I liked something that was very powerful and Middle Eastern, so I started to get into that a bit, and so I actually converted. I was officially converted in a New Jersey mosque.
Yeah, but that would be, you would get into an abstract sense of God from LaRouche's writings, right?
Yes, yes.
And then LaRouche is not, he supports some streams of Islam, so you would have somehow thought that would be a great thing to be because it wasn't Christian.
Right, and you know, I actually had a positive experience because when I was in LaRouche, I didn't have a lot of money. I only get like $40 a week, so I was hungry, so these Muslim Brotherhood, they basically take me out to eat, and they'd feed me, and if they need anything, and you know, if it wasn't for my past homosexual history, I would have rather been a Muslim than a Mormon, because they take care of their own, they really do, they're more sociable that way, and it's a pity, because I'm really paranoid. I mean, that's what the subgenius people, they want to get me killed. Like, didn't you do, like, gay porn in a Muslim? Like, shouldn't you be stoned to death? I was like, thanks for trying to just get me fucking killed, thanks. And you put up on top of that blasphemy, or according to whoever, the homosexual encounter I had was with a Jewish male.
In Pittsburgh?
No, Philadelphia, when I was in Rishmumi.
In Philadelphia, you're a Muslim, and you meet a Jewish person, like, in an off hours? Like
No, he just kind of, I'm actually, while I'm sending out LaRouche pamphlets, and then he gives me, like, this weird wink, and then some strange part of me from my past just kind of winks back, and then he starts talking to me, and I bum a cigarette from him, and it's really weird.
It's in the LaRouche office. It's in the LaRouche office.
No, not in the LaRouche office. It's actually out in the street. I'm basically a gay. No, he's not gay. You would say he's a bisexual slash gay, because he has a son. Well, I don't know about his true sexual identity, but I think he definitely has, like, a homosexual persona. I mean, that's why he. That's but, how it ended. So,
but is he a member of the LaRouche group?
Oh no, not at all.
But you're outside the LaRouche.
I was outside handing out pamphlets, and he just comes up to me and starts talking to me.
I see. So that was that. And that's in Philadelphia, and that's before going to Pittsburgh for the university, the community college.
Correct.
Okay, so then you then go to the West Coast.
Yeah. The first time I arrive in California is 2006. After leaving Massachusetts.
And you've been at Berkeley, or this is, no, Berkeley not yet, but it's coming up. But you go to L.A. first?
I go to Southern California first. I arrive in Orange County in Seal Beach, which borders Long Beach, and after that I make, you know, little tiny cities up the way, like Lomita and then some other city, and then I arrive in Culver City.
Right. Now, while you're doing Southern California, it's always great when you first get there. So it's a wonderful environment. What did you, didn't you enjoy being out there? The first time you experienced that kind of weather?
Yeah. Actually, yeah.
I mean, in Florida, but I don't know. That was
Florida's humid. I mean, it got hot during the summer, like if you lived in a crappy apartment, but, you know, I was living in hotels most of the time, so the weather was fine.
So I think I remember you changed a bit out there. You had a whole bunch of new ideas. Because of the environment, I would say, because of the different world there, that wasn't like the East Coast. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
So,
and it was definitely different than the Northwest, too. It was definitely different than the Seattle-Portland feel, too.
Yeah, so here it is, you know, starting since 2000, it's now 6 years, you're seeing a lot of the United States. See, you're doing the beatnik on the road thing in a postmodern way.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You're all over the
and
country.
Everybody, and you know what? I even get labeled that by someone. I get called a lumpen proletariat. Do you know the description of what a lumpen proletariat is?
Yeah, that's from Marxism or communism and stuff like that.
Right, and so I counter and rebuttal and say, well, that comes from the classical liberal roots of Marx's theory of class, which comes from him studying in England, and she's like, no way, and I'm like, well, let me see how he judges a whole swath of people. Well, like, some of it I can agree with, like, because they're exploiters, you know, like drug dealers or prostitutes. But some of these people, honestly, cannot find a work, and so they're slacking, and they're considered counter-revolutionary for slacking. So that's where I find myself right now. But we live in such a media. But Marx contradicts himself, because meanwhile he calls all these people lumpenarians, like a piece of shit, you know, slackers. But then he has a theory of alienation, which is all about all of our desires and needs are separated and mediated by, you know, for example, money or these layers in society that shouldn't be there. So I'm actually alienated by that term, but that's where we are, like, now it's like work or die, you know?
Yeah.